From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from Los Angeles.
This decision is an invitation to legislators, both at the national and state level, to further restrict abortion, and the Supreme Court will let it happen.
In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court votes 5-4 to uphold a ban on late-term abortion. The ruling marks the first time justices have agreed a specific abortion procedure can be banned. But first, the private security firm Blackwater USA is running into opposition from residents and a local Congress member for its plans to build a new military training facility east of San Diego, known simply as Blackwater West.
It's an 824-acre mercenary training camp proposed for the mountains about an hour east of San Diego. There's a fierce amount of local opposition, but Blackwater's pretty strong.
And May Day is coming up. Last year, more than 1.5 million immigrant rights supporters turned out for what was considered the largest day of protest in U.S. history. We'll take a look at what's being planned for this year. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court has handed down what's being called one of the biggest setbacks for the abortion rights movement in years. On Wednesday, the court voted 5-4 to uphold a ban on certain types of abortion done in the second trimester. This marks the first time the Supreme Court has ruled a specific abortion procedure can be banned. It's also the first time, Roe v. Wade, that justices approved an abortion restriction that does not contain an exception for the health of the woman. Doctors can now be jailed for up to 2 years if they violate the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act of 2003. Both of President Bush's nominees to the court, Chief Justice John Roberts and Samuel Alito, voted for the ban. In her dissenting opinion, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg called the court's decision alarming and irrational. Ginsburg took the rare step of reading parts of her dissent from the bench. She said, quote, "For the first time since Roe, the court blesses a prohibition with no exception protecting a woman's health." Writing in the majority, Justice Kennedy claimed the ban was in fact good for women because it protects them from undergoing a procedure that they might not fully understand and that they might later regret. Eleanor Smeal of the Feminist Majority said the ruling is a direct assault on Roe v. Wade.
This decision is an invitation to legislators, both at the national and state level, to further restrict abortion, and the Supreme Court will let it happen.
Anti-abortion groups hail the decision. This is Jay Sekulow, an attorney for the American Center for Law and Justice.
I think it's going to be a huge momentum shift for the pro-life movement. The opinion is very, very significant.
We'll have more on the ruling later in the broadcast. In Iraq, over 300 people died on Wednesday in one of the bloodiest days of the war. The deadliest incident took place in a food market in the Shia-dominated Sadria neighborhood of Baghdad. A car bomb exploded in the afternoon, killing over 140 people. One shopkeeper said the area had been turned into a swimming pool of blood. The bombing killed many workers who were helping to rebuild the market, which was destroyed in another blast in February. That bombing killed 137 people. Earlier in the day, a suicide car bomb attack on a police checkpoint in Sadr City killed 35 people. Another parked car bomb killed at least 11 people near a hospital in the Karada section of Baghdad. The attack on Sadria Market was the deadliest bombing in the 9 weeks since President Bush sent thousands of more U.S. troops into Iraq to secure Baghdad. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates blamed al-Qaeda for Wednesday's attacks and said military planners had anticipated such acts of violence. But Pentagon planners are privately expressing concern. One official told the McClatchy newspapers another 100,000 troops are needed to properly protect Baghdad. There has been a startling new development in the Virginia Tech school massacre. Last night, NBC News announced the gunman, Cho Sung Hui, had mailed the network a multimedia package of disturbing video statements, a written manifesto, and photographs of him holding the guns he used to kill at least 30 of his classmates and teachers. NBC aired some of his video statements.
"There are a million chances and ways to have avoided today, but you decided to spill my blood. You forced me into a corner and gave me only one option. The decision was yours. Now you have blood on your hands that will never wash off.
NBC also aired a second video of Cho Sung-hui.
You spit on your face and have trash shoved down your throat. Do you know what it feels like to dig your own grave? Do you know what it feels like to have your throat slashed from ear to ear? Do you know what it feels like to be torched alive? Do you know what it feels like to be humiliated and be impaled upon on a cross and left to bleed to death for your amusement? You have never felt a single ounce of pain your whole life. Yet you want to inject as much misery in our lives as you can, just because you can. You had everything you wanted. Your Mercedes wasn't enough, you brats. Your golden necklaces weren't enough, you snobs. Your trust fund wasn't enough. Your vodka and cognac weren't enough. All your debaucheries weren't enough. Those weren't enough to fulfill your hedonistic needs.
NBC reported the package was postmarked just after 9 a.m. on Monday, during the lull between the two sets of shootings. Meanwhile, the Virginia Tech police have revealed Cho was institutionalized in 2005 after he was accused of stalking two women. The campus police interviewed him after the second woman filed a complaint and asked that Cho have no further contact with her. This is Virginia Tech Police Chief Wendell Flincham.
Followed up the next morning and spoke with Cho concerning this matter. Later that day, our department received a call from an acquaintance of Cho's who was concerned that Cho might be suicidal. Officers again met with Cho and talked with him at length. Out of concern for Cho, officers asked him to speak to a counselor. He went voluntarily to the police department. Based on that interaction with the counselor, a temporary detention order was obtained and Cho was taken to a mental health facility.
Flincham did not say how long he stayed at the hospital, but ABC News is reporting he was released the following day. A psychologist certified Cho as mentally ill, but he concluded Cho, quote, does not present an imminent danger to himself or others. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez is heading to Capitol Hill today to testify about his role in the dismissal of eight U.S. attorneys. In an opening statement released in advance, Gonzalez says he has nothing to hide. But Gonzalez indicates he may not be able to provide definite answers on the extent of his role in the firings. Meanwhile, the House Judiciary Committee is considering offering immunity to one of Gonzalez's top aides, Monica Goodling. Goodling's the former counsel to Gonzalez, who served as the Justice Department's liaison to the White House. She has so far refused to testify about her role in the scandal. Meanwhile, the Republican National Committee has rejected a demand from House Democrats to hand over emails related to the firings. Several top White House officials, including Karl Rove, used RNC email accounts apparently in an attempt to skirt laws dictating government accounts. In news from Africa, a United Nations panel has accused the Sudanese government of violating a UN arms embargo by flying military aircraft, weapons, and ammunition into Darfur. The report claims Sudan is transporting the military aid in planes disguised to look like aircraft, UN aircraft. The Sudanese government says the report is based on fabrications. On Wednesday, President Bush warned Sudan's government it has one last chance to stop violence in Darfur, or else the United States will impose sanctions and consider other punitive options.
I have spoken in the past about the need to end Sudan's use of military aircraft to attack innocent civilians. We're also looking at what steps the international community could take to deny Sudan's government the ability to fly its military aircraft over Darfur. And if we do not begin to see signs of good faith and commitments, we will hear calls for even sterner measures. Situation doesn't have to come to that.
President Bush made the comments in a speech at the U.S. Holocaust Museum. In Afghanistan, over 100 journalists are calling on the country's attorney general to resign after police armed with AK-47s raided the Afghanistan's largest TV network. Three journalists were detained during the raid. Several others were beaten and kicked by police officers. Security camera footage captured the raid on film. Journalists covering the incident were also detained and their tapes were seized. The attorney general ordered the raid after he claimed the network had misquoted him. This is Afghan parliamentarian Shukriya Barakzai.
They really crossed the law. That's the reality, unfortunately. It's a small example for the journalists in Afghanistan. We have lots of violence. The enemy of freedom of expression, it's not just those whom they are against this government. Somehow our government also is against because they're afraid.
Back in the United States, the FBI has raided the home of Republican Congressmember John Doolittle of California and his wife, Julie. The couple has been closely tied to the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal. Agents seized computers and documents. Congressman Doolittle said the raid targeted his wife's consulting business. Abramoff hired Julie Doolittle's firm to raise funds for a charity he founded. In military news, U.S. Army medic Agustin Aguayo has been released from a military prison in Germany. He was jailed after he refused to return to Iraq. He's been in military custody for the past 8 months. And finally, in Wisconsin, 40 student activists from the Campus Anti-War Network have taken part in an all-night sit-in at Senator Herb Kohl's Madison office. The students called on Senator Kohl to cut off funding for the Iraq War, fully fund veterans' health care, hand over Iraq to Iraqis, and to ban depleted uranium. The sit-in took place after the student activists walked out of classes to protest the war. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we're broadcasting from Los Angeles, California. About 150 miles south of here, near the U.S.-Mexico border, the private security firm Blackwater is planning to build a new military training center known simply as Blackwater West. Plans for the new site include multiple firing ranges, training towers, an armory, a helipad, an urban simulation training area, and a driving track. Blackwater plans to build the facility on an 800-acre chicken and cattle ranch near Potrero, a tiny rural town about 45 miles east of San Diego. The project won preliminary approval from the local planning board in December, but since then, more than half the registered voters of Potrero have signed a petition opposing it. The residents are being joined by a growing coalition of environmentalists and peace activists. The project will ultimately need the approval of the County Planning Commission and the Board of Supervisors, a process that could take up to 2 years. Earlier this month, a normally routine county planning meeting on the project drew over 100 protesters. They were met by 36 police and sheriff's deputies, and people entering the meeting were required to walk through a metal detector. Blackwater West is also running into opposition from a local Democratic congressmember who represents the area. Representative Bob Filner said he's exploring legislation to block the project. Congressmember Filner joins us on the phone right now from Washington, D.C., here in Los Angeles. I'm joined by Raymond Lutz, one of the main organizers opposing the Blackwater West facility. He runs the website StopBlackwater.net and CitizensOversight.org. And in our Firehouse studio in New York, I'm joined by Jeremy Scahill, author of the New York Times bestseller, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. We called Blackwater to invite them on the program. They declined our request. I want to begin with Raymond Lutz. First, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Talk about the organizing that's happening, what you understand will be happening in your community. And start by telling us, well, describe Potrero.
Potrero is only about 800 or so people. It's a very beautiful little valley. There's hills that go to the rear, and behind those hills, there's a beautiful valley, mostly untouched, but there has been a chicken ranch there in the past. It's completely non-functional now. But it is a valley that is part of a chain that starts up from the north, and there's about five valleys that are all part of a natural preserve, that should be a preserve. This valley should be returned, in my opinion, back to its natural state. Even condors have been sighted, the first time since 1910 that we've seen a condor that had been, we've spent quite a bit of money replanting those, and to see one coming up through that area, this could be a problem if you have a lot of people shooting at things. They might see that that is some sort of a target. But it's just having 300 shooters out there with, they say, only single-shot weapons, But in the Blackwater North facility, which is about 125 miles west of Chicago, the gentleman I've been in contact with says that they've now introduced automatic weapons, which makes sense. If you figure they're going to be training for Iraq, they're going to need to know how to use a M16 or AK-47. So the idea that they're only going to be training with single-shot weapons is sort of a question. But if you're a resident and you live right over the hill and you have what I think looks like about 300 shooters shooting all day, you're going to be hearing this in the quietness of the backcountry. A lot of the citizens, I've told about a third of the residents in Potrero, have moved there specifically because of illnesses to get away from the city contamination. And they are very sensitive. I just talked to a woman yesterday who told me that she's got a ranch. Her doctor says she has to stay away, and she's right next to this facility. So if they go in, she's worried, of course, that this is going to contaminate her ability to stay alive. She's very, very worried.
And how much is the community organizing right now?
Right now, they're going into a recall movement to recall the planning board. This is something is possible. We said there were 300 people that signed the petition, but they didn't go through all the hoops in order to get those...
300 of what? Just over 400 registered voters?
There's 425 registered voters.
So three-quarters of the registered voters have signed a petition.
Those 300 were not checked well enough, so they need to go back and check. They only need 133 registered voters in Potrero to sign a petition, and then a recall election would go forward. And the planning board itself is just an advisory board. These are just people, homeowners in the area, who volunteer to sit on this board. And you can imagine these planning boards, what do they usually talk about? Somebody's garage is too big or they're building a fence, something simple. It's an 824 mercenary training camp with 300 people coming up every week for training is just incomprehensible. It's way beyond what they should be able to do. And to say, well, we have no conflict of interest, when you're in a little tiny community with only 800 people and you're talking about putting in this massive installation, there's no way there's not a conflict of interest with everyone there. So they voted 7-0. How they voted, there's one member who came on board in January. This vote was taken in December, so she didn't get to vote on it. They made the vote early for, I think, just to get around her vote. And she's against it. She's the only one that's against it.
I want to bring in Congressmember Filner in Washington, D.C. You represent this area. What are you doing about Blackwater West?
Well, first, I want to, of course, support the community, which is in my district. And when you get a petition of three-quarters of a community, you have to take notice of that and support what they want. Clearly, this is not does not fit into the way of life, the rural area of Potrero, and should be stopped just on those grounds, aside from environmental grounds. But when you see Blackwater, you have all kinds of other problems with what they're doing in the world, what they're doing in Iraq, how they function as a company. Their mercenaries in Iraq are unaccountable to any law there, and they have taken people out who have been accused of murder. They have not been upfront with relatives of some of the contractors who were killed. So this is not a company you want to have in your backyard.
Well, did Blackwater approach you when it set its sights on this chicken farm?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Did Blackwater approach you? Discuss it with you.
They didn't. I wouldn't expect them to. I don't have as a land use authority. You know, as a congressman, the county supervisors do. And what they did was do all their work lining up support at both the county and some other levels before the community ever knew this was happening. And if you have to work like that, work against the community rather than with it, you know something's wrong.
Is there a dispute over whether you're in charge of this area or Congressmember Duncan Hunter is, the former head of the House Armed Services Committee?
Well, in the redistricting of that took place after the last census, this was an area that Congressman Hunter had for 20 years, and some of that county was transferred to me. And so, you know, I am the congressman for this area, It doesn't mean that he's apparently an ally of Blackwater, an ally of anything that is bad in Iraq, actually. He has also intervened by trying to show that his friendship with the company should be respected. And in fact, he intervened, I think, in trying to get the landowner to sell to them in a quick fashion. You would expect us to be on different sides of this kind of issue.
Congressmember, let me bring Jeremy Scahill into this, Democracy Now! Correspondent, Puffin Foundation Fellow with the Nation Institute, author of Blackwater. Jeremy, congratulations. It's hit the New York Times bestseller list now for weeks. Talk about your coverage of this particular issue and the significance of Blackwater.
Well, first of all, Blackwater has some incredibly powerful Republican connections in California. Representative Filner mentioned Duncan Hunter. Of course, Duncan Hunter is a Republican candidate for president right now and is one of the people that Blackwater met with in the aftermath of the Fallujah ambush. And those meetings ultimately led to Blackwater rising to prominence within the Congress, the Republican-controlled Congress. But also, Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, worked as an intern for Representative Dana Rohrabacher, another California Republican. In fact, when Blackwater was founded, both Dana Rohrabacher and Representative John Doolittle were brought out at the company's expense to be at Blackwater's grand opening. So these are deep Republican ties in California that Blackwater has. But there's another story that's gotten no attention with this, and that is that Arnold Schwarzenegger's Department of Homeland Security hired a man named Chris Bertelli in November of 2005 to work in emergency preparedness in the Department of Homeland Security in California. Bertelli was Blackwater's leading lobbyist, working for the Alexander Strategy Group, the powerful K Street Republican firm staffed and founded by former senior staffers of Tom DeLay. Bertelli was one of the people steering Eric Prince and other Blackwater executives around Capitol Hill after the Fallujah ambush in 2004. Bertelli also was one of the lobbyists for Blackwater who took the lead on trying to block the Pentagon or the Congress from applying the military code of justice, the court-martial system, to Blackwater and other contractors operating in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so I think serious questions need to be raised about the involvement of several leading Republicans in the Congress in this project, but also in this man who was a lobbyist for Blackwater and connected to the Alexander Strategy Group, who now is apparently a senior official within Arnold Schwarzenegger's Department of Homeland Security. These are very serious contacts within the administration of Schwarzenegger and this sort of revolving door when you have Bertelli going from being a lobbyist with Blackwater to being in the Department of Homeland Security, and all of a sudden Blackwater's talking about an expansion into California and talking about responding to earthquakes and other natural disasters in California.
Congressmember Filner, I know you have to go. We're going to continue this conversation after break, but what specifically, what kind of legislation are you thinking about introducing?
Well, I've been trying to figure out a way that, from my level, I could help the local community again, because this is a county supervisor's decision, and I know they are being, you know, investigated by the government oversight committee in the Congress. I know that there are serious legal questions raised about the way they their contractors are not are immune apparently from any either military or civilian law. And I'm just trying to explore, and you know, maybe our author is going to be in San Diego, I understand, next week or the week after. I'm sorry I can't be there to meet you. But I'm just trying to be creative about bringing the issue into a higher level of public knowledge by trying to say, you know, maybe any group that is under investigation by the Congress cannot expand until those issues are settled. It's difficult. I'm in a difficult position to try to do something, but I'm trying to be creative and find a way. And if any of the people on the call or your audience have ideas, I'd be happy to take them.
Do you have an email address?
I'm sorry?
Do you have an email address?
We're at the... I think it's congress/filner at mail, mail.house.gov.
Well, if you can stay with us, that is great. We're going to go to break right now. And Jeremy Scahill, you're going to be speaking in San Diego when?
I'm going to be speaking there in early May. I'm going to be there for a couple of days around May 2nd and 3rd. One thing that I wanted to add, Amy, to what Representative Filner said, is that we have a company here in Blackwater that has said that it doesn't want military law to apply to it, and at the same time, facing wrongful death lawsuits, has argued that it can't be sued in civilian courts, saying that it should be entitled to the same immunity as the U.S. military. So we have a company that is essentially declaring itself above any effective law, and I think that raises serious questions anywhere they go in the world, and particularly in this country. But I'd also like to ask Representative Filner, if he believes that contractors should be withdrawn from Iraq because there's no effective laws governing their presence, effectively we have a Wild West atmosphere. Do you believe, Representative Filner, that the contractors should be pulled out until an effective legal system is put in place?
Oh, no question. And I guess Congress, and even those who have been against the war in Iraq, like myself, have been slow, unfortunately, to recognize how many there are and what they're doing there. You know, it's almost a one-to-one ratio with U.S. troops. And it's like privatizing, you know, everything in America, including our armed forces. So the Out of Iraq Caucus and the Congress has now rewrite and contractors wherever we say the military ought to be withdrawn because of their, you know, this above-the-law kind of attitude and status that they seem to enjoy.
We're going to come back to this discussion. Congressmember Bob Filner, thanks for joining us from Washington, D.C., represents the area. Potrero, he's a California's 51st congressional district. And we're also joined in studio here in California by a Potrero resident who is active in trying to block the site, block the sighting of Blackwater West. Raymond Lutz and Jeremy Scahill is also with us, who is author of Blackwater. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back with them in a minute.
I'm not Iran.
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with the discussion of Blackwater West and the opposition to this facility. We're joined by Raymond Lutz, one of the main organizers opposing the Blackwater West facility, runs the website stopblackwater.net and citizensoversight.org. And in New York, we're joined by Jeremy Scahill. His book is called Blackwater, the rise of the world's most powerful mercenary army. Jeremy, let's just go back for a minute and talk about the power of Blackwater right now. You've been on in the last few weeks talking about this, but for people who are not familiar with this company, how it came into being and how it's grown.
Well, Amy, this is a company that a decade ago basically didn't exist, and today they have contracts with the State Department alone totaling $750 million. That doesn't count the work Blackwater does for the Department of Defense or for U.S. intelligence agencies. The company's become nothing short of the Bush administration's Praetorian Guard for the so-called global war on terror. It's Blackwater that protects the U.S. ambassador in Iraq, other senior officials, regional occupation offices, their training forces in Afghanistan. They've been deployed in the oil-rich Caspian Sea in Azerbaijan, right near Iran. Blackwater has operated here on U.S. soil in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, where the company billed U.S. taxpayers $950 per day per Blackwater operative deployed in the hurricane zone. And as we've been talking about today, this is a company that increasingly has its sights set on domestic deployments inside of the U.S., opening Blackwater North a few weeks ago, now trying to open Blackwater West. And Amy, it should be said that Blackwater has the largest private military facility in the world, based on the Great Dismal Swamp of North Carolina. This is a 7,000-acre compound where they have a man-made lake for amphibious landings. They have airstrips. They have a fleet of aircraft, more than 20 aircraft on their compound. And it's headed by a right-wing Christian fundamentalist who is not only a bankroller of President Bush's campaigns and his allies, but has very deep ties to the religious right in this country, people like James Dobson, Gary Bauer, Chuck Colson. So what we essentially have is a Republican Guard that's headed by a man with an agenda of fighting against secularism and restoring religion in government.
And the connections with the conservative Christian right movement more fully?
Right. Well, Eric Prince's family in Michigan sort of merged with the Amway Corporation empire when Eric Prince's sister, Betsy, married Dick DeVos, the heir to the Amway Corporation. And these two families together really bankrolled the rise of the religious right. They gave the seed money to Gary Bauer to start his Family Research Council. They gave significant funding to James Dobson and his Focus on the Family Prayer Warrior Network. Eric Prince was an intern in George H.W. Bush's White House, but he complained that it wasn't conservative enough for him. Prince himself, the head of Blackwater, continues to give significant funding to a wide variety of right-wing Christian causes. He's on the board of Christian Freedom International, an evangelical missionary organization that operates in Muslim countries around the world. And one of Prince's closer political allies has been Chuck Colson. In fact, Prince and organizations he's affiliated with have given funding to Chuck Colson, who was Nixon's hatchet man during Watergate, turned into a born-again Christian and evangelical minister. Prince has funded Chuck Colson's fellowship program to run faith-based prisons. Colson runs a faith-based prison in Texas, in Sugar Land, Texas, the district of former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. They actually run the lives of 200 prisoners. So this is a guy who has very deep connections to the Christian conservative religious right movement and the White House.
As Blackwater sets up these, what do you call them, camps, bases?
I call them private military bases.
Combat towns. They attempted to do one in the Philippines, but people fought back. Can you describe what happened, Jeremy?
Right. Blackwater started to build up a jungle training facility in the Philippines at an old, at the Subic Naval Base there. And several senior Philippines legislators started raising serious questions about the operation of a mercenary company inside of the borders of the Philippines. And there was a tremendous outcry domestically in the Philippines to the idea of citizens of that country participating as mercenaries in the war in Iraq. And this started brewing about a year ago, and leading columnists in the papers there took it on. And Blackwater just days ago announced that it was pulling out of its plan to operate in the Philippines. Now they're meeting this fierce resistance from people in this rural community in California. Blackwater has been yanked out of a sort of obscurity that they'd enjoyed for a while, and now we have Congress focusing in on it. And I think the crucial issue right now, Amy, is to get the Democrats, the Democratic leadership, to stop ignoring Blackwater and other contractors in any withdrawal plan that they put forward. As of now, despite the fact that Representative Filner says he's calling for a withdrawal of U.S. contractors from Iraq, that is not the position of the Democratic leadership, and it's certainly an issue that needs to be raised within the Congress, because almost half the occupation force in Iraq now comes from the private sector, and if the Democrats ignore that half of the occupation force, they're essentially ignoring half of the war on the ground, and not to mention the fact that 650,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed. So the Democrats really need to pay much closer attention to the dramatic privatization of this war.
Well, Jeremy, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Jeremy Scahill, author of the New York Times bestseller, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Jeremy, you'll be on The Daily Show tonight?
That's what I understand.
And beginning a California tour from May 26 to May... from April 26 to May 6. He'll be in La Mesa, California on May 2nd, San Diego on May 1st, on Thursday, April 26 in Santa Barbara, and on April 28 in Oakland, California. Raymond Lutz, I want to end with you. You're not a Potrero resident, so how did you get involved with this?
We operate citizens oversight, and this encourages citizens to become involved in their local local planning groups, councils, boards, what have you. As a citizen in a democracy, it's your responsibility to be responsible for the entire government, which is a lot to ask. So, but if we get everybody to say, I'm just going to do one thing, just one board a month, one or two times a month, what we noticed in this case was that the Potrero planning group was more or less a circus. They don't know what they're doing at all. They weren't allowing people to speak anonymously, which they wanted to in this case. They were very worried about, if you can imagine, a mercenary training camp going in. If you're going to speak against them, maybe there's some worry that you don't want to identify yourself. And it's allowed to not sign in, not pay, and you can speak, but it's not stated explicitly in the Brown Act that you can also speak anonymously. The state attorney general's office has given me an opinion that indeed you can. You can say I've declined to say who I am. At this camp, they're going to have an 18,000 square foot armory. That's almost a half an acre of guns and ammunition. This is probably more than New York City has. Most police stations only have a little locker, or they take their firearms home. And this is a very fire-sensitive area. We just had a huge cedar fire that came through. The brush in this area is overhead high, and it is designed to burn. The brush there, it has to burn or the seeds don't open. So this dead wood in these things is everyone's worried. There's only one way in and out. They have a helicopter pad planned. Say they're not going to use it only for emergencies. But the worry is, of course, we have this site of Blackwater that everyone's worried about, that they're mercenary above the law. They're the Praetorian Guard for the right-wingers. But we've got to try to stop this at the planning level, which is the only way that we can see that we can get it to stop. The Sierra Club is pessimistic. We're hoping that the fact that we've sighted a condor in the area, the fact that there's five cultural remains, excavation-type areas there that are of concern, and it's bordered by Cleveland National Forest to the north and Bureau of Land Management lands to the other sides. Part of the area is the Cleveland National Forest lands. Senator Barbara Boxer had recently designated the Hauser Wilderness, which is just north of this, Hauser Creek, which this water flows into Hauser Creek. We're hoping that perhaps she can increase that Hauser Wilderness to include this. At the state convention, Democratic convention, which occurs next weekend, the 26th through the 29th, I believe, 27th through the 29th in San Diego, we're going to be working the floor to get a resolution passed by the state Democratic people there, and also hopefully can talk to Barbara Boxer to get her to extend this. So we're trying to work on all fronts. The recall election, Bob Filner's work, hopefully Barbara Boxer to extend the Hauser Wilderness. We have a conservation group that wants to buy it if they can get past the purchase of Blackwater that's already in process.
Well, Raymond Lutz, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We will certainly continue to follow this struggle as we move now to a major national story of the day, the Supreme Court handing down what's being called one of the biggest setbacks for the abortion rights movement in years. On Wednesday, the court voted 5-4 to uphold a ban on late-term abortion. The so-called Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act was signed into law in 2003. But it had been held up by rulings from lower courts. The Supreme Court ruling marks the first time justices have agreed a specific abortion procedure can be banned. It's also the first time since Roe v. Wade that justices approved an abortion restriction that does not contain an exception for the health of the mother. In her dissenting opinion, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg called the decision alarming and irrational. She said, quote, the ruling tolerates, indeed applauds, federal intervention to ban nationwide a procedure found necessary and proper in certain cases by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. She later continues, it cannot be understood as anything other than an effort to chip away at a right declared again and again by this court and with increasing comprehension of its centrality to women's lives. Louise Melling joins us now in the Firehouse studio in New York. She's director of the Reproductive Freedom Project at the American Civil Liberties Union. As an attorney, she's appeared in federal and state courts around the country to challenge laws that restrict reproductive rights. Louise Melling, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Explain the significance of this ruling.
This decision, as you said, is devastating. It's incredibly significant. This is, as you commented on, the first time the court has upheld a restriction on abortion that lacks protections for women's health. This is the first ever federal law banning certain abortions, and the court has upheld that. This really is a decision that undermines a core principle of Roe that's been in place since 1973, that women's health must remain paramount.
Talk about the significance also of this majority, the 5-4 majority, with the new Chief Justice, John Roberts, with Samuel Alito, the two George W. Bush nominees to the Supreme Court, ruling with a majority against late-term abortion.
Well, what you see is a real shift, right? In 2000, the Supreme Court considered a law that was also called a partial birth abortion law, and the court struck that law. And in striking that law, what the court did was there, as it had always recognized women's health to be paramount. What the court did in 2000 was also say, we're going to listen to doctors, and where some doctors say that procedures that might be banned here are the safest for women's health, we will defer to those doctors, and there has to be a health exception to ensure that women's health is protected. And in that decision, the court also looked to, as you said, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists' view. ACOG is the leading medical organization for physicians who care for women during pregnancies. Now, and that decision was 5-4 also with O'Connor, Justice O'Connor, in the majority. Now, 7 years later, what's really different is you have two new members of the court. This is the first decision of the court since on abortion, since Justice O'Connor resigned, and you have a very, very significantly different holding.
So what are you planning? What is the ACLU, what are reproductive rights groups planning right now? Where do you see this going from here?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, it's alarming that the court isn't protecting women's health, so we're concerned about women's health. What's also alarming is that the court's decision has language that's so broad that it really does constitute an invitation to legislatures to further restrict abortions. It sends a signal that in many respects the court thinks that legislators, not doctors, may be the ones best positioned to make decisions about our most fundamental options. So, you know, of course, what we're going to be concerned about is figuring out how to best continue to protect women's health and to continue to protect the ability of women to decide, as we've been able to for over three decades, to end pregnancies when we, in consultation with our doctors and whoever else we think is appropriate, decide that's the best course for us.
And in terms of doctors or women who have abortions being criminally charged, can you elaborate on this?
Well, this is a federal law. This is a law that reaches, you know, doctors who provide abortions in every state all across the country. And if a doctor performs any procedure that's viewed as prohibited by this law, the doctor is at risk of prosecution, and if convicted, this would be a federal crime. I mean, again, this is unprecedented. For the first time ever, you have a federal law making certain abortions a crime, a law that would say that doctors, you know, can be prosecuted for federal violations for performing abortions that the doctor believes and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists supported would be best for a woman's health.
And what are the future cases that you see most significant coming up around the country?
Well, I think what will be most significant is to see what happens in response to this decision. I mean, I think if you're looking at the press, you already see that anti-choice activists feel emboldened by this decision. I think what's incredibly important is that those of us who really care about abortion and protecting access to abortion and protecting women's health take action and are active in the political process, including in the legislative process, to ensure continued constitutional protection, continued legislative protection for what is important for women's health and women's equality.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and we will, of course, continue to cover the significance of this. Louise Melling, our guest with the American Civil Liberties Union. When we come back from break, well, May Day is coming up, and there are massive rallies for immigration rights being planned across the country. We'll speak with one of the leading organizers here in Los Angeles, Javier Rodriguez. But as we go to break, a preview of the documentary Gigante Despierta, The Giant Awakens, about the immigrant rights movement in this country.
Unprecedented wave of protests, as many as 2 million people took to the streets on Monday in more than 100 cities and towns around the country to march for immigrants' rights.
If we can put that in a context of millions of dollars that we produce every single day, just think about it, the impact that we're going to cause on May 1st.
More than 100,000 people converged in Lower Manhattan for a rally near City Hall. In Atlanta, as many as 80,000 people flooded the streets. In Phoenix, more than 100,000 rallied at the Arizona Capitol.
50,000 marched in
25,000 in Madison,
10,000
in Boston. 8,000 in Omaha, Nebraska.
San Diego,
Miami, Birmingham, Idaho, Utah, Iowa, Dallas drew 500,000 people, the largest protests in the city's history.
I'm here because to support everybody who's working here in the United States, not just Latin Americans, but the whole world, just Irish, Chinese, everybody. This is a giant, and we're not going to stay asleep.
Uno, dos, one.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, and that is from gigantedespierta.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica radio stations, NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations. We're also broadcasting public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks. On Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375 Link TV. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish in transcript and audio form. Over 150 radio stations around the country and the world are taking those headlines. As we turn now to what's coming up, we're less than 2 weeks away from May Day. On that date last year, more than 1.5 million immigrant rights supporters turned out for what was considered the largest day of protest in U.S. history. Many had walked off the job in an action meant to highlight the impact of living without immigrants. Organizers are expecting an even greater turnout this year. Protests and walkouts are planned across the country for what's being called the Great American Boycott 2. the immigrant rights movement is facing several challenges. President Bush recently vowed to renew his effort to pass immigration reform, while immigrant workers have been subjected to a growing wave of raids and deportations. Javier Rodriguez is our guest, an organizer with the March 25th Coalition, one of the main groups behind the mass rallies here in Los Angeles last year and for this upcoming May Day as well. Welcome to Democracy Now, Javier.
Thank you very much, Amy.
Can you talk about what you are planning this year?
Well, we have 63 organizations that have convened the second national boycott for May 1st, Great American Boycott 2. We have, at this time, approximately 16 states on the list with about 75 cities, the major cities in the country, from L.A. all the way to New York, Texas, Colorado, the state of Washington, the Midwest, Illinois, Wisconsin.
What do you think has happened in terms of immigrant rights issues since last year?
Well, we defeated Sensenbrenner, the Hagel-Martinez bill, and a new version of immigration reform has come to the fore. It is essentially pro-corporate design immigration reform. And the difference now in terms of us, we're a lot better organized. We have been able to pretty much consolidate the mass movement. And now we are, as you said, almost 2 weeks towards May 1st. And we expect a large turnout, not just on the streets in over 75 cities, but also the boycott. Last year, just in LA alone, we almost closed the whole city down. We had over 4 million people participating. This time around, we may have the same amount. We may affect the economy the same way and in the rest of the country. But also, we have gone over to the other side to organize in Mexico, and there's major support in Mexico. We have over 1,000 organizations in Mexico in different parts, and we are closing several of the ports of entry from Mexico to the U.S. Last year, just in Juarez, from Juarez and El Paso, from Juarez, over 40,000 workers refused to enter to work to El Paso on May 1st. This time around, it'll be Brownsville, Reynosa, McAllen border, and also the Juarez again, and hopefully we will have Tijuana. In addition to Mexico, we also have Venezuela expressing a big, big movement of solidarity with the May 1st movement here for immigration reform for the 12 to 13 million people here, over 600,000 women with over 3.3 million children that are U.S. citizens. That's what the struggle is about today.
What difference has it made that Democrats are now in power in Congress?
Very little at this time, very little. Yes, last year the Congress was controlled by the extreme right. We were able to participate in the overall electorate that defeated, especially the anti-war sentiment. And now we have, let's say, the first proposal came from the Democrats, the Gutierrez flake bill. But it's essentially corporate design. It is designed to make a worker who has been here 7 years, 14 years, even up to 38 years, which is my mechanic, the project, the proposal calls for a wait of approximately 14 years to be able to get your green card, besides having a guest worker program, besides having a totally enforcement, let's say, section very similar to the Sensenbrenner bill.
when President Bush announced his so-called guest worker plan, it was a few days after another mass rally at the beginning of April of tens of thousands of people here in Los Angeles. Among the things in Bush's plan is to create a new visa category for undocumented workers who could apply for renewable three-year work permits for $3,500. Then in order to become legal residents, they would have to return to their home countries, apply, and pay a $10,000 fine. The proposal also prohibits temporary workers from bringing their families into the country. Your response?
It's absurd. It's ridiculous. Let's say that $13,500 would pay for the coyote, for the drug smuggler, five times. It is an insult, and what we see is President Bush pushing for an immigration reform that is what we think designed to counterweight, to water down any effort by the Democrats to approve any immigration reform, any future immigration reform, either this year or the following year.
The significance of immigrants fighting in the army, being sent to Iraq.
It's a shame. It is making criminals, murderers, mercenaries out of immigrants, and in exchange for a green card, and it is making. What is it? An estimated 40,000 immigrants. A human being that is going after human beings in another country in a war that should not be, a war that it's totally a war of occupation, of, with politically designed rationale, as it is known now. It was totally fabricated. So if immigrants are going with a sense of patriotism, with a sense of getting in exchange their green card, or rather citizenship, it is totally wrong.
What about these detention facilities around the country? I think now a record of more than 26,000 immigrants currently imprisoned in the United States. We have been doing a big story out of Taylor, Texas, the Don Hutto Family Detention Center there, where immigrants are held, about 200 children. I think the ACLU has brought suit. You've also got prisons at Raymondville, the largest prison camp in the United States. Can you talk about these?
It is what we consider now the immigration industrial complex. Prisons are on the, are on the vision of government and also industry and the enterprise. And along with the wall, it is nothing but a money-making scheme, the building of prisons, the building of detention centers. And it is totally also in violation of human rights to imprison children in this country, immigrant children, just for the so-called crime of crossing into the United States, just as adults.
How, finally, are you organizing in your plans for May? What are the different organizations?
Let's say one of them, the International Longshoremen Workers Union, or West Coast Union, they have passed a resolution to close down the ports on May 1st. The whole West Coast is going to be closed. The trucking industry, those that pull the cargo, also are with us. United Teachers of Los Angeles are with us. The major coalitions in the country that closed down the cities last year, San Antonio, the Border Social Forum, the New York May 1st Coalition.
Javier Rodriguez, others. We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for joining us. Does it for today's broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Hoda Kadoosh, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Mate, Jen Utes. I want to wish Elizabeth Press a very happy birthday. Jeremy Scahill will be in Los Angeles on April 30th. You can go to his website, blackwaterbook.com. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.